I will call the meeting to order. We are gathered once again on EL 11-006 in the matter of the complaint by Oaktree Energy LLC against Northwestern Energy for refusing to enter into a purchase power agreement. The questions that were posted for today's agenda are, how shall the commission rule on Oaktree's complaint, or how shall the commission proceed? I would like to begin, first of all, by thanking both parties for their responses by 5 o'clock on Monday. I will simply say, from my perspective to Oaktree, I understand the rationale of your counteroffer, as it were, but I am not prepared to go there. I was not prepared to go anything above the number that I had calculated. And so while I understand where you're coming from, I'm not prepared to pursue that avenue today. But do thank you for your time and looking at that very seriously. With that, this may be fairly free-flowing. I know there's commissioners that probably have some motions on how to proceed. But I know the one thing that I would like to do is ask Blue LaFave some questions based on some of the additional research that I've done. But I'd turn to other commissioners if they have questions that they'd like to ask of anybody at this point. No other questions there. Blue, are you still with us?
Yes, I am, Commissioner.
Thank you. I've spent some time looking at Mr. Lewis's Exhibit 9, where he has his energy forecast, and I've spent some time looking at your Exhibit 3, and perhaps in this whole process I should have picked this up someplace along the line, but I just haven't, so I need you to explain to me. And I want to ask some questions, first of all. And ultimately, what I need to have explained is how Northwestern arrived at the $35 figure given the inputs that I see on your Exhibit 3. And obviously, I'm not seeing the formulas that are on this spreadsheet. And if I could, that might have explained it to me. But since I can't see those, you might have to walk me through it. The first question that I've got for you, in the third column, we've got Northwestern on-peak avoided cost and then the off-peak avoided cost in the fourth column. Those don't match perfectly the numbers that Mr. Lewis came up with, so where did these particular sets of numbers come from?
Okay, this is described in my testimony. I don't know exactly right off the top of my head now how the calculation came up with the avoided cost of 35, but I'll try to go through it where these particular numbers come from. If you look at
and Blue, if I could just tell you, I've read your testimony a number of times and I'm still not grasping it, and so that's why I'm asking. I appreciate your patience.
No, not a problem. Not a problem. The third column over that says on peak, and the fourth column over that says off-peak, 2013 to 2016 is what we filed in 2011 as recorded in our avoided cost filing that fall. So those numbers come directly from that avoided cost filing. Then the numbers starting in 2023, you'll see the $49 and the $30. Those two numbers are directly from Steve Lewis's forecast that he filed that you were referring to earlier, and they continue on down through 2032. So that's where those two sets of numbers came from. The numbers in between those two sets and have been discussed a couple different times, because we did not have the avoided cost calculation. It's a complicated calculation. We're working on trying to get something that we can automate it and do it quicker, but it's a very lengthy calculation. So what I did, as I described, was I just did a straight line between that last avoided cost filing, which was in 2016, and the 2023 number, which is 100% in the market as using Steve Lewis's numbers, And I took that time frame, just did a straight line divide to come up with the numbers in between those 2 years. And then when you do the overall, the 35, the light load hours represents X number of hours in a year. The heavy load are the other hours, and you divide you average those two together for the respective hours, and you come up with the $35.
Okay, and I want to, and I appreciate the answer as to where the numbers came from in the third and fourth column. I need to ask some other questions as between that point and your $35 point. Looking at the 2023 time period where we're looking at making purchases 100% of the time, so at that point, are you utilizing the high load numbers or the low load numbers or some combination of those?
For Steve Lewis's, let me...
And my presumption would be that if you're making a purchase 100% of the time, that's going to be you're going to be using the high load numbers. But I need to know exactly how you did that.
Well, the high load numbers, we got to be very careful with the terminology. The heavy load numbers are the ones that are in the third column. The light load numbers are the ones in the fourth column.
That's correct.
So we've got on peak, off peak. So you have heavy load in the third column and light load in the fourth column. And then there are X number of heavy load hours in a given year, X number of light load hours in a given year. So if you want an annual blended, then you blend them two together with the respective hours.
And so that blend, and I see your 56 and 44 number, did you use that blend for every one of these years, or did that change as you went to a higher and higher percentage of needing to purchase?
No, that's two different blends. When I'm talking about the blend between a heavy and a light load, that doesn't change. Your heavy load hours and your light load hours stay the same regardless of what year you're in. It's just the number of hours in a given year. The blend, as far as how much generation is included in the avoided cost calculation versus market purchases. After year 2023, we assumed that we were 100% in the market.
Okay. That, I think, answers my question. I think...
The percentage that's in the second column is the percentage that's representing the amount of generation versus the amount of it's strictly an estimate because the forecasting light load and heavy load are not going to progress in the future the same as far as how much generation versus purchasing. We just roughly took an estimate based on our load balancing curve that in 2023 that's where that number will be 100% in the market for at least 1 megawatt on all hours. In likelihood, we probably won't be there in light load hours yet, but we had to make an estimate someplace.
And just so I'm clear, in the year 2023, you would have been using this $49.54 number for the entire...
We would have used the $49.54 for the heavy load hours and $30.25 for the light load hours.
Okay.
Heavy load hours are typically between 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock, and light load hours are between the remaining hours of a given day, with the exception of weekends and holidays. So depending on the year, it also does change on the holidays. But if you add up all the hours in any given year, that will tell you how many hours you have light load, how many hours you have heavy load, and that's the split that you use between those two columns.
So what's the likelihood that you'd actually be making purchases in those light load hours, even in those out years?
If we had time to go through an entire model, and like I said, we're working on it. We'll build it as we go. It just takes a lot of time. We've got some programmers working on it right now. But I'm guessing even in my career, it would be unlikely that we're making purchases every hour with our current unless we get a significant load on our system. But again, we had to pick a point at some point in time with what we knew at the time we did this study. We've looked at it a little bit more. Some of the internal people that I'm talking to saying within the next 20 years, we still won't be purchasing at all hours and heavy on light load. But it gets smaller and smaller every year.
Okay. Blue, thank you for walking me through that. I think that's the answers that I need for today. With that, questions from other commissioners?
I don't have questions, but I'll have comments.
When you're ready.
Yep, I'm seeing Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, I'll have some questions when we have a motion.
Okay. Commissioner Feagin, should we try see if Commissioner Hansen has a motion, or do you want to make some comments first?
I'll make some comments first.
Okay, Commissioner Feagin.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. First of all, I want to thank all three parties for your hard work, and you guys have spent hundreds and hundreds of hours trying to give us information that we can evaluate and come up with a decision as a commission. First of all, I am most comfortable as a commissioner when the three parties negotiate. And then actually the commission makes a decision or a ruling on those negotiations. We've learned a lot, and we have learned that there are all sorts of different points of view. As a commissioner, I believe that staff is on the right track of using the hybrid method and using the hybrid method with Northwestern, because Northwestern is a vertically integrated system, which they generate most of their power most of the time right now on their own. So the market price method is interesting, and of course we use that. I don't think that's the right method for this docket. There are all sorts of other things that we need to talk about, and I know Commissioner Hansen will be talking about it, and Commissioner Nelson. I also believe that Northwestern needs to put in a carbon gust. And actually, there is testimony in their briefings that talks about a $5, $10, $15 carbon cost, which I do believe would be appropriate because, of course, Oak Tree has brought that, has a carbon cost, but Northwestern has given us information on one but has left it out. Also, we need to look at the natural gas, and we need to realize that we need to look probably at current market price and look at the issues that are surrounding natural gas today and not 2 years ago or 18 months ago. So we have to kind of reevaluate natural gas and use that of what we see today. Because as a commissioner, I want to make sure we make a ruling that is as fair as possible. And when we have new information on natural gas today, as a commissioner, I believe we have to use that. So there are all sorts of different issues. There are more points that I will certainly add to the motion, but those are the points I wanted to make in an opening statement.
Thank you. Commissioner Hansen, would you like to proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a motion, and it occurs to me I can ask one of the questions I have ahead of time, if that's all right. I'm curious from the parties, primarily from Northwestern at this juncture. I think I know what Oak Tree's position would be on the answer. Of using either Titan One project or the MISO and method in calculating the capacity credit for the facility's output. Could I hear from Northwestern?
Commissioner Hansen, this is Al Brogan. And I'm on a speakerphone, so if I'm not coming over well enough, please let me know and I'll pick up the handset.
It sounds very good.
Thank you. With respect to determining the capacity credits for a wind farm, I think we need to recognize three things. First, although not all of us, and that includes Northwestern and Western Area Power Administration, WAPA, are members of MISO to a very big extent. MISO is the big dog in the room. Secondly, we need to recognize that MISO has established a method by which wind facilities get their initial capacity calculation, as you will, by using the system average, and that after the first year of operation, that capacity credit changes every year based on the wind farm's actual output at the hours of peak. So long as MISO and MRO, Midwest Reliability Organization, are working together to enforce reliability standards, I think it's incumbent upon Northwestern to follow what MISO does. With respect to Titan, I'm a little unclear as to the question. If the question was, should we use the same method that is used for Titan, well, that's essentially what's being done, is the MISO method. If the question is, should we use the Titan contract, again, as we've said previously in our briefs and in testimony, the Titan contract was entered into when markets were substantially different, and it does not represent a part of Northwestern's avoidable cost. We're going to pay for Titan for what it delivers, regardless of whether we purchase from Oak Tree or not. So there's no avoidable cost associated with Titan. And I may have misinterpreted the question, and if so, Commissioner Hansen, I apologize.
No, you did not. You answered it. I appreciate your answer. I thought there was a difference between Titan 1 method and the MISO method. I'm curious if any of the staff have anything to add to that. If not, if everyone believes that they are similar.
Mr.
I'm debating and trying to come up with whether I'm totally comfortable with using Titan 1 or whether I use the MISO method. And
yeah, I guess my understanding is that Titan 1 uses the MISO method. So one and the same to us.
So if I say Titan 1, then I'm safe.
Correct.
All right. I've heard it from three parties now, so I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, if I may, since I asked questions, didn't necessarily make comments, but if it's...
You may proceed.
I have a number of motions. I'm wondering whether I should, I suspect, make them individually or all in one.
I would be comfortable with one singular motion, and then if we have issues, we can move to amend various portions.
All right. In docket EL 11-006, Oak Tree versus Northwestern, I move that the commission find and conclude in general agreement with staff's conclusions in its post-hearing brief. Number one, that given Northwestern's status as a vertically integrated utility with predominant reliance on its own internal generation at this time, the hybrid method is the proper method to calculate avoided costs for Northwestern's South Dakota system. Secondly, that Northwestern did not, however, incorporate projected carbon cost inputs into its use of this method, and also may have utilized low natural gas inputs and electric market inputs. And as a result, the Commission cannot reliably determine the proper avoided cost with the data and analysis currently in the record. Number three, that the carbon emission cost values of $5 per ton starting in 2015 and shifting to $10 a ton starting in 2020 and rising to $15 a ton in 2025 as estimated by Lands Energy are reasonable carbon emission costs estimates in the present environment and are the appropriate carbon emissions cost values to be included in the party's respective hybrid method analysis of avoided cost. Fourth, that Northwestern is obligated to purchase Oak Tree's output because a legally enforceable obligation, an LEO, was created by Oak Tree on February 25, 2011. Fifth, that Oak Tree is entitled to capacity credit for the facility's output commencing in 2012, with the capacity contribution to be determined and adjusted in accordance with the method Northwestern is using for the Titan One project, and such capacity credit shall be incorporated into the hybrid method beginning in 2012. Sixth, that the proper avoided cost contract term is 20 years. I further move that on or before June 1, 2012, the parties shall file with the Commission such additional analysis employing the hybrid method and such additional pre-filed testimony as they deem necessary to enable the Commission to determine the following. 1. The proper application of the hybrid method. 2. The proper natural gas inputs to use in the hybrid method based on current market conditions and projections. 3. The proper electric market rates that the parties may deem warranted to reflect current market conditions and projections, taking into consideration the carbon emission costs previously approved. Excuse me, they haven't been previously approved, but they appear in the previous comments. And any adjustments to gas prices. Four, the proper capacity contribution and resulting capacity credits to be included in the avoided cost and added into the hybrid method under the Titan One method. Five, Northwestern's avoided cost levelized over a 20-year period. The parties may file rebuttal testimony on or before June 13, 2012. I further move that the Commission shall schedule this matter for further hearing on June 19, 2012, with the hearing to begin following adjournment of the Commission's regular meeting scheduled for that date. I further move that the Commission direct staff to open a rulemaking docket for the purpose of considering on statewide basis the proper standards that should govern avoided cost determinations in the future in this state, including, but not limited to, the requirements for creation of a legally enforceable obligation, the acceptable methodology or methodologies for determination of avoided cost, and the appropriateness of particular methods in specified circumstances, appropriate contract terms, and the standards for determination of when capacity credits shall be allowed and the appropriate methods for computing the magnitude and duration of such credits. Mr. Chairman, that's the complete motion, and I am concerned a bit with timelines at this point, and I'd be interested in hearing from the parties, and certainly turn it over to you because you're in charge and you will determine whether the commissioners speak first or whether we go with questions.
Based on the motion, I do have some questions for the parties, and maybe the best would be for us to ask our questions of the parties, and then we can proceed with our discussion. But Commissioner Hansen, I'd let you go first with your questions.
Thank you. I struggled a bit with whether I would include the carbon emission cost values as I did. It's very challenging to look at Congress and try and figure out exactly what they're going to be doing. So, and granted, there's some real challenges in putting something of this nature together because, on one hand, we're saying that we're making this motion to proceed under these circumstances, and yet we're asking staff to help to work through a analysis in order to a rulemaking process as well, in order to determine really what should be done with this type of a docket. So it's kind of a strange animal to go ahead to proceed with it and then to go through the process on determining how to proceed with it. So I'm it's a challenge from that standpoint. It does set a precedent, but I think under the circumstances, we need to proceed under that process. So what I'm really curious about is something somewhat benign, and that is timelines, and I think those can actually be worked out. I don't think I need to ask a question. We don't need to go through a process on that. I think that that can be worked out by staff. So at this juncture, I would just say that I echo the comments of Commissioner Feagin and the statements that you made earlier. I sincerely appreciate the amount of time and effort that the parties have gone into with this and the tremendous amount of work that staff did in guiding us through this process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions of the parties? Seeing none, I do have one, and I guess as you heard the motion, there was significant emphasis on utilizing current market conditions and projections, and I would compare that to utilizing the market projections and conditions that were in place in February 2011 when the LEO was created. And I guess I'd like to hear from both parties maybe some argument, if you could, at this point, and if not, certainly in whatever you'll be filing from here on, as to whether we should be reliant upon current conditions and current projections or those that were in place in February of 2011. Mr. Uda, since you're in the room, I'll turn to you first if you'd like to comment on that question.
I believe that the... necessarily based on the way that the FERC rules are written and the case law on the subject matter, that the determination of avoided cost as of the date of the LEO is necessarily a prospective determination. I think it would be inappropriate to look at current market conditions, for a couple of reasons, I think. The first is because current market conditions can be misleading. And what I mean by that is, it wasn't so long ago that, we were experiencing a situation where, I had clients who were buying power in the market at market rates, and they thought that was a pretty good deal. And then all of a sudden, in the Western Interconnect, we had the California energy crisis of 2000-2001. And all of a sudden, they were paying $150 a megawatt hour or more for their contracts, and they couldn't operate. Some utilities got caught in the same situation, and that spawned years of litigation. So looking, at the short-term kind of situation can be misleading. And I also think that when you look at, when you say current, depends on what you mean by current market conditions. I think it's appropriate to look at current market conditions as of February 25th, 2011, because that was the time frame which we had to try to, figure out exactly the financing for this proposal and retain experts and have them look at those kind of things. And, there's a lot of ways in which, utility planning is done similarly, in the sense that, the utility values the project, it makes a proposal to state commissions, and as long as those costs are prudently incurred and the project is built, typically speaking, there's not a retrospective look at whether or not this was substantially above market. I would like to add another war story, if you will. I represented a project before the Montana Commission in 2002, and it came in and it said, we'd like to sell our output to Northwestern at $32.75 for 20 years. And that would have looked like a real bargain now. And my point is that the future is not always going to be lower. There's a certain tendency to think that whatever's going on right now is what will go on in the future. And, I think that, one thing we've talked about with these forecasts is, they're all going to be wrong. And so the real question is, what sort of acceptable range is there in terms of risk of being wrong, and what sort of risk does it pose? So I guess that's a long answer, and I apologize for that. But what I would say is I think it's most appropriate, based on PURPA policy and regulations and to the extent we have case law, to look at this as a prospective determination as of February 25th, 2011, as opposed to let's look at what's going on in the market right now. That can change on a daily basis.
You mentioned case law twice. Can you cite any cases for us that would direct us to the need to use February 2011 numbers?
Well, there are a couple of cases, and I can't remember them right off the top of my head, but I think one of them is actually a New York case, Saranac Power Partners, and I believe that the court there pointed out that QFs are allowed to lock in their rate. I would also point you to two recent FERC decisions. One is the J.D. Wind 1 case and also the Cedar Creek Wind case, in which the commission made it very clear that Cedar Creek Wind, I think, is particularly illustrative of this point, because what had happened in that case was the qualifying facility had signed a contract and sent it back to the utility, and the utility knew that a new avoided cost rate was going to go into effect, and they waited until after the deadline to sign the contract so that the new lower rate would go into effect. And FERC said, that's exactly why we have the legally enforceable obligation situation, is to avoid this kind of situation where you have a utility that just simply holds on to a contract so a lower rate applies. And so I think what the commission was saying at that point is that the point at which the legally enforceable obligation is created, that's the rate that applies. And so the rate has to necessarily be the rate on the date the LEO applies. And I think you can't really base a rate on present information if you're really trying to lock it in as of the date of February 25th, 2011. I think it has to be based on information at that time.
Thank you. Mr. Brogan, a response?
Chairman Nelson, I'd like to respond maybe in reverse order. First, I would say that I believe that the characterization of the Cedar Wind case is not entirely in line with the details of that case. I think we need to keep in mind that that's based out of Idaho, that in Idaho, QFs at that time up to 10 megawatts were entitled to what are called standard offer rates. There was a published standard offer rate. The Idaho PUC had announced that as of December 14th of the applicable year, wind and solar QFs would not be eligible for a standard offer rate if they were larger than 100 kW. The question wasn't the rate, but whether or not the QF was entitled to the published rate. And as Mr. Uda correctly stated, FERC determined that when everything had been agreed upon, the utility could not just refuse to sign the contract or fail to sign the contract and then put the QF in a position where it had to compete for basically a slot in selling to the utility. Whether or not this commission is obligated to look at only information that was available on February 25th of 2011, I believe is a debatable point. I think that's especially the case, whereas here the commission is deciding that a legally enforceable obligation was created, even though the QF had not committed to sell power at an avoided cost. I would also comment that I think the Saranac case is not comparable to this issue. In Saranac, the issue is whether or not after QFs had entered into contracts, long-term contracts, at the New York Commission's mandated rate, and it turned out that that mandated rate was too high, you know, 2020 hindsight, I guess, whether or not the utilities had some method of reforming or lowering those contract rates. And I think we all know the answer to that was no. But I don't think that case stands for anything about the information that the commission may look at.
Mr. Chairman, might I just have a brief
rejection? May I finish?
Oh, I apologize, Mr. Brogan. I didn't realize you weren't done.
Go ahead, Mr. Brogan.
Given that, as we have argued, as Northwestern has argued throughout the case, we believe that the commission has discretion to go either way. Certainly, if it picks the date of February 25th, 2010, and only wants to look at what was known or should have been known then, I anticipate there will be a lot of arguments about what was really known then. You know, we can look at what the market was, but we can't look at what was in everybody's mind then. And then the final thing I would suggest is that at some point in here, in this whole process, we have to keep in mind it's the people of South Dakota that are going to be footing the bill. And we need to have a methodology that makes sure that those people, Northwestern South Dakota ratepayers, are financially indifferent. And somebody has to speak for the interest of those consumers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Uda.
Well, at the outset, I want to apologize for Mr. Brogan. I took his pause as him being finished, and I didn't intend for that to happen. And I'm sorry, Al. At any rate, just a couple of things. First of all, I don't want to get too bogged down in the details of Saranac and Cedar Creek Wind. Northwestern's position makes no sense. I mean, this is one of the problems I've had with a number of the arguments that they've made. And this is why its position makes no sense. If the FERC's point in Cedar Creek Wind, regardless of whether it was because the standard offer rate didn't apply and you would have to go in the queue or whatever else, the point that FERC has consistently made is that by refusing to sign a contract, you cannot change the avoided cost because that interferes with the reasonable investment-backed expectations. FERC in Order 69 could not have been clearer that the purpose of this was to promote the development of new technologies, and that in order to do that, there had to be some certainty. So the date and the Saranac case, I didn't quote it because I think that it's particularly apropos on its facts to this situation. I quoted it because it uses the phrase lock in. QFs have the right to lock in a rate. That is how the legally enforceable obligation works. At the date at which it's created, it locks in the rate. Now, whatever that rate is what we're debating here. And so my point would be, I think, you know, the interpretation of the cases, those cases speak for themselves. I don't need to argue about them too much. But I just want to say I think that the appropriate look is, and Mr. Brogan's making a good point. I don't think he's wrong to say, well, you know, we're going to have to go back and look at what people would have known. But that's been kind of what our effort has been here from the beginning. Mr. Lockhart's point is, you know, when he was relying on the Black & Veatch energy market perspective, it only gets done twice a year. His obligation, he consulted with people at Black & Veatch, was to say, well, you know, there's movement in the gas market. Is this a temporary change or is this a long-term fundamental change that's going to change the way we do our forecast? These are the kind of things Black & Veatch invests an enormous amount of resources in. So I agree with him to a certain extent, but that's kind of been the whole exercise from our standpoint. What I'm saying bottom line is I think it would be substantial error, that's as distinguished from a minor error, for the commission to say, well, let's look at, you know, the situation now and then sort of go back to February 25th, 2011. I think you have to try to make this determination as of what the parties knew or reasonably should have known as of February 25th, 2011.
Thank you. Other questions from the commission? I guess maybe the only, and I do want to follow up on where Commissioner Hansen was going in regard to the dates that we've put in here to further this proceeding. Are there any objections from either of the parties as to the dates that that we've selected? Mr. Uda?
Let me just say, and I haven't had a chance to confer with my clients really on this. Obviously we would prefer, as short a deadline as we possibly could, because, the real issue for us is, we're facing a situation where the production tax credits are expiring and the potential for being able to use bonus depreciation is expiring as of the end of this year. And there is a substantial risk that the production tax credit will not be renewed. So we would like to be as short a time frame as possible. We understand, the commission has limited resources and you have other things that you have to do. And I think I would, at least from my experience, basically a 6 to 7 week process is, I know from your perspective, extraordinarily fast. So I think, one of the things that we would have to consider is, basically, two separate filings consistent with your order. One would be with the production tax credit and one without if it doesn't get renewed. Because I think that substantially affects, what price we would be able to produce.
But if I might, and obviously I'm the commissioner that's been pretty sensitive to your timeline, but the production tax credit, whether it's there or not, doesn't affect the avoided cost number.
No, I acknowledge
that. And
that's
what we're here to find.
Yeah, I understand, and you're absolutely correct, Chairman Nelson. The only point I was making is that as we move through time, the fact is, we're not going to claim that the production tax credit is part of the avoided cost. We may just want to make you aware of the difference of what you're looking at, not that it would be critical to your determination of the actual avoided cost.
Thank you. Mr. Brogan, your comments on the proposed time frame?
Chairman Nelson, I understand the need for an accelerated schedule. However, the initial June 1st deadline is going to be very difficult, at least as I see it. And I may be analyzing it wrong, but at this point it appears to me that Northwestern will need to apparently find a new expert with respect to electric and natural gas prices, as the commission doesn't seem to accept Lands Energy's forecast, though it does for carbon. Secondly, Northwestern is in the process of making three filings before the Montana Public Service Commission that it has to have done before the end of May. And then third, I have a prior commitment that I cannot get out of without substantial personal expense that has me unavailable to work on any of this matter from Saturday, May 19th through Saturday, May 26th. And it's not a commitment for a vacation, incidentally. It is a working commitment. That said, we will do whatever whatever needs to be done to fit the commission's schedule. I just would emphasize that we're concerned about basically such a short time to develop the initial analysis by June 1st, 2012. I guess the last thing I would say is that for this to work at all, I think we have to be sure that we're not going to be engaging in discovery between the initial testimony on June 1st or whatever date is set and the rebuttal testimony. If we have discovery that we have to develop and, more importantly, respond to during that period, the turnaround, I think, would be impossible for us. Thank you.
If you'll give us just a minute, I'm conferring with Commission Counsel. Staff, do you have an opinion on the schedule?
Certainly, it's hard for staff to comment on the party's various schedules, but I would start by saying I don't necessarily know why they would need to find a new witness. Lands Energy doesn't have to necessarily agree with your order to follow the order and to insert the numbers as you've ordered. And second of all, I don't know what discovery would need to be done. Again, you're ordering particular numbers or ordering a particular mode, so a mode of action. So I don't know why discovery would be necessary either.
Thank you. Yeah, just give us a minute while I confer with Commission Counsel. Mr. Brogan, one of the things that we've just kicked around here, Mr. Smith and myself, is pushing back that June 1st date. Perhaps, and I'm going to pull up a calendar here, pushing that back just a bit to try to accommodate that week that you're unavailable to work on the project.
Chairman Nelson, I would really appreciate that accommodation.
If we push that back to June 6th, would that help and then keep any rebuttal testimony to June 13th?
That would be very helpful, the June 6th date. And we have turned around and provided testimony in a week before, in a week's time period and other stages of this docket. I think we could do it again. It's not easy, but it can be done.
Understand. I appreciate your flexibility, and that allows us to try to move this along as quickly as possible. With that, discussion from the commission on the motion. I think the only comment, Commissioner Hansen, I intend to support your motion. I appreciate your putting this together for us and bringing this to us. The only question that I've got, and it was something that you hinted at, is the last paragraph about opening the rulemaking proceeding. And it does seem to me maybe a little bit disjointed that we open that proceeding before we finish this particular docket, that there may be questions raised in that then all of a sudden people are saying, well, why aren't you applying that in this docket? And to me, that seems like it may muddy the waters as we try to wrap this docket up as quickly as possible. Thoughts on that?
Yes, so that's one of the reasons that, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that I expressed what I did. It's a situation where you're going to go out and tell people how to drive a car, and then later on you're going to learn how to drive it yourself. And it's an interesting situation, but if we have further requests that come before us, we obviously, all three of us, well, all of us who participated in this, recognize that we need to have a variety of things established. And in order to do that, we have to go through this process as recommended at the very end. And so it's a matter of they both need to get done, and they both need to get done pretty soon. Obviously, the staff's directive would take place concurrently with this, but consecutively. It would take place afterwards. So if you're comfortable in taking those in two different motions, that's fine, but I really think we need to get started with both of them.
I would be comfortable if it would be the understanding that, frankly, that the docket be opened, but that nothing be done with the docket until we've concluded EL 11006, because I agree with you that we certainly need to do the rulemaking. But so far as making anything publicly available or proposed rules or anything like that, I'd be very uncomfortable doing that before we wrap this one up.
I think staff would appreciate knowing that they don't have to be doing both of them at the same time as well.
And so if that would be just kind of the understanding all the way around, then I'm certainly on board with supporting this.
Certainly.
So do we, just to make it clear, do we just amend the motion that says the docket opens after the conclusion of this complaint?
I think we just basically told staff right now that, and the chairman has that prerogative of moving forward in the directive, I believe.
So it'll reflect in the minutes.
Well, and Mr. Smith,
just a comment too. I mean, the opening of a docket to say that's going to be a policy thing we're going to pursue. I mean, a docket like that's probably going to be, it's probably a year-long process. You know, this is not going to be a simple thing, you know, something like that. So just opening it opens it, but it makes some commitment on our part to move it along and proceed. But I wouldn't perceive significant activity happening necessarily immediately. So I don't know that there's actually any time conflict or conflict that would happen there. I think Commissioner Hansen's motion is attempting to do is to, and following on staff's recommendation, is that at some point here, given what we've experienced throughout this whole docket process of this Oak Tree docket, is, you know, the commission at some point, it would be useful to take a broad-based look at this in terms of figuring out how do we want to run the avoided cost and the QF rights process going forward and put some direction into it on a prospective basis. But just comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Fegan.
Fegan votes aye.
And Nelson votes aye. Motion carries. I do have one additional request. Mr. LaFave, going back to my questioning on your Exhibit 3, would it be possible for me to get, and I'm guessing it's going to end up having to be part of the record, but your actual spreadsheet so I can see the formulas?
I'm sure it can be part of that. Our intention hopefully will be to have a full-blown one hopefully built by June 6th.
Okay, then you and I we're tracking identically on where we need to go with this, and I appreciate that. But in the meantime, if you could provide me with you know just what's behind that Exhibit 3, I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Anything else for the good of the order? Mr. Rizlov.
And I'm following up on Chairman Nelson's request to Mr. LaFave. I would like to ask both parties, not to throw harpoons at this point, but I would like a little better sourcing and a little better formula, derivation, is just a list so that we can replicate those exhibits. I can replicate those exhibits. I'm not privy to all the material that staff gets. And the one thing I've been a stickler about with the staff I've worked with over 35 years is you should be able to look at exhibit and be able to follow it through without playing hide-and-seek in a guessing game. So I would ask both parties to more fully source and point out where the derivation comes from on those exhibits.
On that point, this goes to the issue of discovery. I think you know, I was prodded by my expert on the phone by email that, you know, the very process that you just went through with Northwestern is the reason that if there isn't sufficient transparency, you may need discovery just to be able to better understand somebody's exhibits. And I'm not saying we need to have that in a schedule, because obviously we're trying to get this done as soon as possible, but it may become an issue if we need to find out just, I mean, even somebody's math, you know, make sure that there was appropriate multiplication, subtraction, you know, division. So, you know, with that, I you know, we're comfortable with the schedule, but, you know, it may, if, as Mr. Rizloff points out, there's, you know, there's less than perfect clarity, there may need to be some limited opportunity for discovery, at least to understand better the exhibits.
I appreciate that. Mr. Smith has just had a suggestion that may help in this regard, and that would be our request that as any of these spreadsheet-type documents are submitted to us, that we get the actual live spreadsheets also, so that we can see the math, that we can see the formulas, and know how those are operating. And so if that would be an understanding, that would move this along.
We would be happy to provide that.
Thank you.
Northwestern is comfortable with that also.
Thank you. Any other comments? Seeing none, is there a motion?
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn. Those in favor vote aye. Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Fegan.
Fegan votes aye.
Nelson votes aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. We are adjourned.